All right, good afternoon. It's great to be here. I'm a native Californian. It's always great to be back, especially in the springtime, especially at a lovely place like this. Let me acknowledge the people that did the work that I'm going to be talking about, in particular Guthrie Partridge just finished his degree. Wenwei Li is postdoc. Yanan Liao is a more junior student. And Ramzi Kumar is actually in a different group now. But let me also thank Hank Stoff, who we've benefited greatly from collaborations over the years, and in particular on this work. So Wolfgang gave a beautiful introduction to polarized Fermi gases this morning, and so I don't really need to say very much more. But let me just emphasize what the phases are, some very interesting novel phases that one should be able to see predicted in these polarized gases. So looking in K-space, probably the most well-known of these exotic phases, this is one that breaks both translational and rotational symmetry, is the formation of pairs with a non-zero center of mass momentum. And so this is something that Wolfgang mentioned that people are looking at in heavy fermion compounds, and there's some preliminary evidence, but maybe nothing for sure at this point. And so this is a very interesting phase, and we're still very interested in looking at that. Something very similar to the FFLO state, but rather than breaking just translational symmetry, it only breaks rotational symmetry. This is the deformation of the Fermi sphere in momentum space. And you can see that the minority can deform in such a way that in the majority as well, in the opposite direction, that you can get pairing where these two Fermi energies meet. The Sarma phase, or also known as a breach pair phase, is a phase where if the gap or the difference in chemical potentials is big enough, the difference between the two Fermi energies is sufficiently big, then you can have a gapless excitation spectrum. Called the Sarma or the breached pair, but for lower differences in chemical potential, you can get an ordinary BCS superfluid that's polarized. And then finally, in real space, the rest of these are in K space, but in real space, you could see a phase separation between a superfluid, it's an evenly paired superfluid in the center, evenly paired core, surrounded by the excess unpaired atoms around that core. Now, there's a fundamental incompatibility between magnetism and superconductivity. There's the Meissner effects, which excludes magnetic fields, so it's difficult to polarize a superconductor. But in contrast, it's rather straightforward to make a polarized atomic gas. And so this is an example where atomic gases really can be useful to study effects which are more difficult to look at in condensed matter systems. In addition to condensed matter and superconductivity, there are implications to color superconductivity, and in particular to the pairing of quarks and neutron stars, where you have cold, dense quark matter, and because of the massive strange quark, you have a situation where you have Fermi surfaces which are unmatched. So we set out, motivated mainly by the FFLO state, we set out to do some of these experiments. And the idea is very simple in cold atom physics, because you have two states, the two hyperfine states, of this is in lithium-6, and they're separated by about 80 megahertz. You drive RF transitions between them. It's very straightforward then to make an unequal imbalance mixture, which is shown here on the right. So here the red atoms are the greater number of those than the yellow atoms, and consequently their Fermi energies are unmatched. So we define, in order to describe these gases, we define a polarization P, which is equal to the ratio of the population difference to the total number. And by driving these transitions, and always in our case, state 1 is the majority, so P is always between 0 and 1. 0 corresponds to the usual situation where N1 is equal to N2, the completely unpolarized gas. And 1 is the case where you have just one species, just state 1, and that would be completely polarized. So because of these states are two different hyperfine levels and you can independently probe them optically, it's possible to independently take images of state 1 or state 2. From that you can get numbers, the two different populations of the two states, and thereby measure this polarization P. So as you've heard this morning, there's an experiment at MIT and our experiment Rice, they were both published in the same issue of Science about a year, a little more than a year ago. And this is the, in essence, in a nutshell, our results. And I think what I can do here is show you every point I want to make in these images. And so everything I'm going to show from here out will be quantitative demonstrations of the qualitative physics that we can describe just by looking at these images themselves. So everything should be contained here. So again, the polarization is defined by this ratio. These are three sets of images. State 1 is the upper state. State 2 is the middle. And these are the two images that we take. And then by subtracting state 2 from state 1, you get the difference. So if P is equal to 0, there's equal numbers of state 1 and state 2. And you see, as you expect, no difference. Now, as you go up in polarization, this is now 18%. You start to see that the state 2 distribution is a little bit smaller than the state 1. There are fewer atoms. And as you go up to 37%, this difference increases. Now, the three points I want to point out that you can get just by looking at these images is that there's a paired core. And although these are column density images, the fact that the core is as wide radially as the majority means that if it's dark, then it's completely paired. There's an equal number of spin-up and spin-down atoms in the center. So that's number one. And with that realization, then the minority distribution represents the distribution of the core, of this paired core, while the atoms are paired. And then the difference distribution represents the distribution of the excess fermions. The second point is that the phase boundary between this this collection of pairs, this core, and the outside excess unpaired atoms is very sharp. And so you can see that the phase boundary here is almost flat here, and here it's very good examples. And moreover, the third point is that the core is deforming. Now this is a very interesting observation. It's actually the key to the results that I'm going to show you now more quantitatively. The fact that the core deforms produces these very unique types of distributions. And you can see that the core no longer has the same aspect ratio as the majority. In fact, it does not have the same equal potential lines as the trap. It's deforming. It's becoming more spherical as the polarization increases. And so as you go up to the very highest polarization, 95%, actually, this looks like the aspect ratio has changed, has gone below 1, but this is an artifact of the way we're rescaling these images. The aspect ratio here is about 3 to 1, whereas the aspect ratio over here is 30 to 1. But nonetheless, you can see that the aspect ratio has changed very dramatically. This droplet in the core has gotten less and less prolate and more oblate. And presumably, if you could keep going, it would become nearly spherical. Okay, so this is an image from our data in the Science magazine where you can see this very clearly. The kind of transparent region in the center is the distribution of this core, of this paired core, and the excess unpaired fermions are this more red color down around the bottom. And you can see, I think, very clearly that the excess atoms are preferentially collecting in these axial poles over here and over here, relatively few of them in the equatorial plane. So this is a result of this deformation, the fact that the core is expanding radially but contracting axially causes the excess atoms to collect over here at the polar region. So this is a quantitative plot of the of this deformation showing the aspect ratio, the ratio of the majority of the length to the width of the distribution, both for the majority and the minority. You can see the majority doesn't change very much as a function of polarization, whereas the minority changes by an order of magnitude over the range of polarization that we've probed, which is going from about 0 to about 97%. So it's a very dramatic, very obvious deformation of this core. So these are, again, these column density images. If you integrate the last remaining radial dimension of these two-dimensional images, you can get something we call the axial density, which has a dimension of 1 over length. And the axial densities have this characteristic in the difference distribution, this characteristic dip in the middle with this double peak-like structure. That comes about because the core is shrinking axially, is raising up in the center, causing there to be a greater subtraction in the middle than there otherwise would be, and that produces this characteristic minimum. So this minimum here is a hallmark, actually, of this deformation. So this double peak structure is actually a result of the deformation of this core. All right, so what's causing the deformation? Well, Eric Mueller realized that when you have a first-order phase transition, you have a phase boundary, you should have surface energy. And that surface energy then gives rise to a surface tension, and it's very natural to think that the surface tension is going to squeeze the superfluid up. And so, in fact, he calculated the surface tension with one adjustable parameter, fit it to our data, that's the solid line, and you could see a pretty good fit, especially in compared to the theory without surface tension. Without surface tension, these axial density distributions have this flat, characteristic flat top. Hank Stoff did basically the same calculation in our newer data. His calculation are shown here. This is now the column density rather than the axial density. And you can see the fits are these blue circles, and they're remarkably good. Now, he's got one parameter to fit this data, but it's only one parameter over the entire data set. So all the polarization, every polarization has the same one parameter, the surface tension, and that parameter is just a numerical scaling factor of order one. So you can see that with the assumption of surface tension, that you get really very remarkable, I would say, agreement with the data. So given this agreement with the data that now several groups have done in this calculation, I think we're very confident in saying, and it makes sense, that there would be a surface tension between these phase boundaries that gives rise to the deformation of this core. So the phase separation, in fact, requires surface tension. When you have a first-order phase transition, you must have a surface energy between the phases, and that will give rise to some kind of deformation in any non-spherical distribution. All right, now you can do atom tomography, as Wolfgang described as well, where if you have cylindrical symmetry in your distributions, you can take your column densities and reconstruct the real three-dimensional density distribution. So that's shown here. This is the column density cut. This is the reconstructed three-dimensional density. This is a cut through the center line. And you can see that the minority and majority have the same center density. And so this is now quantitatively shows you that, yes, indeed, there is the core is evenly paired. So that is shown here on this plot of the ratio of the densities. It's the ratio of state 1 to state 2 as a function of P. And again, you could see that the core is evenly paired. There's a little bit of noise in the very highest polarizations, and we believe that that's due to the reconstruction process itself. And so as far as we can tell, the ratio of the central densities is 1 for all polarizations and very different from what you'd expect for a normal gas. For a normal gas in which there's no change in the distribution, then you'd expect the ratio to follow this dotted line. And so the point I really want to make here is that there is no Clogston limit. And so even though we're going to a situation where the difference in chemical potentials, the difference in Fermi energies is large compared to the gap, nonetheless, we still see a paired core. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't think that. I think that there is a little bit of bias in the fitting that gives rise to this. And the stuff going over here, going on in the end, is really a fluctuation. I really think that that's due to the bad statistics that you have when you have very few atoms left. Well, in fact, that trend goes all the way back to here. And so I think that really you could draw a straight line which has a very shallow slope. And I believe that that has to do with a bias in the way it's fitted. Okay. I'll show you data which definitely does go above 0.7, and which is a higher temperature data. And this data, what I would say is that there's a slight bias. In fact, there's a slight straight line. But if you look at the average here, it's still way below what you'd expect for a normal gas. And so what you really want to compare to is this dotted line. And if you compare to the, say, at 90%, where this ratio should be about 5, we're seeing maybe the average is somewhere below 1.5. So I think it's really quite clear. Yeah. Right. Right. So in Wolfgang's data, and it is quite clear, I'll show that a little bit later, at around 0.75, it actually starts shooting up and it follows this curve. And our data does not follow that curve. This one? That's due to the statistics, because this is, what, about 98% polarization. There's very few minority atoms. It's very there's a lot of fluctuation in doing the reconstruction of the real three-dimensional density. It's all unitary.
Okay,
unitary. Yeah, yeah, sorry. Everything that we're looking at here is at unitarity limit. Yeah.
You can't look away from the unitary.
Yep. Yeah, we can. I'll say a little bit about that. Yeah. All right, so we've looked at, everything I've shown you here is at our lowest temperatures, which when we fit to, as Rudy was describing, using the technique of John Thomas, we fit to the data, to a Thomas Fermi distribution, it fits to temperatures less than 0.05 TEF. It could be lower than that, this is an upper limit, but it clearly is below 0.05. Now that data, this coldest data, is characterized by three things: the distortion of the superfluid core, the sharp phase boundary, and the fact that there's a paired core for nearly all P. Now we've also looked at higher temperatures, and this is an effective temperature of 0.2 TF. So again, there is a root 1 plus beta factor in here. As Rudy says, it's about 1.5. Kathy Levin has done a calculation on this, that you can really pull out maybe a more true temperature from this, but an effective temperature of about 0.2. And it's characterized by three things. One is that there's no distortion. And so the minority, the center part, has exactly the same ratio, the trap geometry of the minority. The minority has the same aspect ratio of the majority. And so it doesn't distort. And you can see that, I think, very clearly from comparing these two sets of images. And there's a partially polarized shell, and so instead of having these sharp phase boundaries separating the superfluid core from the unpaired fermions, you see instead this characteristic flat top, which I described before, and the difference distribution then monotonically decreases away from that. Thirdly, there's a paired center up to finite P. So if you look now again at the same plot that I showed before, this is the one for the low temperature. where we believe that there is no Clarkson limit. This is the higher temperature data, 0.2 TF. And here you could see it somewhere around 60 to 70%. It begins to follow this normal gas prediction quite well. And so here we claim that this is the Clarkson limit. It becomes unpaired for higher polarization, whereas this gas does not. Now, this compares very nicely to the theory of Kathy Levin and her group. This is the low temperature expectation. This is, again, the ratio of the majority to the minority for a temperature of 0.05, and they calculate that it's 1 for all polarization. And so that's in reasonably good agreement with what we see, whereas for the higher temperature data, they show that it goes up at around 0.7 or 0.75, begins to diverge from 1, and this is where that you lose the superconducting order. And so these are in very good agreement with what we see. Questions? Yeah, so the normal state's not interacting, and this is why it the ratio jumps up like this. So we see these two distinct distributions, and they're really qualitatively and quantitatively very different from each other. So let's go on now, look at some phase diagrams. These are phase diagrams that have been proposed by three groups, and they're also, I know Leo has some similar things, but this is a phase diagram by Hank Stokes' group, Mira Parrish and Simons and Cambridge and Kathy Levin's group, where you're looking at temperature versus polarization. They find two superfluid phases. They find the SARMA phase or the polarized superfluid phase or magnetized superfluid phase, I think that Mira calls it, SARMA phase in Kathy's. Phase separation in the lower temperature region of the phase diagram, all three of them roughly the same. And then a normal phase, which in Kathy she has split up into a pseudogap plus a normal region. But what I want to emphasize is that there are two distinct superfluid phases in this phase diagram, and all of these have the phase separation going at, this is all at unitarity, essentially all the way to a polarization of 1. I think Mira's here goes up to about 94%. The rest of these go up to about 1. So there is, this is, whoa. I guess I won't be getting any viruses. That's good to know. Let me just let it go do its thing. We can just move on here.
Yeah. One phase diagram, and they kind of trap the other one. The other two are not in a trap.
Yeah, that's right. So this one's in a trap, and this one is not. But let's. So let me move on, and we'll talk about. Let me get rid of this thing if I can. Okay. Yeah, there are two of them in the trap, and I guess Mira's is not. So. All right. So there are a couple of things about this phase diagram that I want to point out. This is predicted to be a first-order phase boundary, and so you'd expect between phase separation and the normal gas, you'd expect to see surface effects, surface energy, as you would expect in any first-order phase transition. This is a second-order phase boundary where you do not expect to see. Everything should be continuous, and you would not see surface tension effects. This, therefore, is a tricritical point separating the three phases. All right, now we can compare our data to this phase diagram. This is the low-temperature data, 0.05, and we see essentially phase separation for all polarizations. That's consistent with this phase diagram if we're sufficiently cold. We see a sharp phase boundary, which is what you'd expect because this is first order. And the distortions then are due to the surface tension effects that you get at a first-order phase boundary. The higher temperature data is consistent with being above the tricritical point because you see no discrete phase boundary, but rather a diffuse one. There's no distortion. There's no surface tension effects. And you see a paired center up to about 60% or so. This should be temperature dependent, but maybe weakly so. So depending on where you're at in temperature, this critical polarization, where it goes normal, is likely to change. Now, we did earlier an experiment that was in an intermediate temperature. This data fits to a temperature of about 0.1 TF. And there we saw that the difference distributions had a hump below 10%, and then suddenly at 10% and above, they developed this characteristic double peak structure. And in fact, this was very dramatic transition. This is at 10%. This is a plot of the axial size of both the majority and the minority. One's black and one's red. Normalized to their respective numbers. And you can see that they're about the same size up to a polarization of 10%. And suddenly, beyond that, you saw that the minority axial dimension begin to diminish rapidly, as we've seen before in the low-temperature data for all polarizations. So what's going on here, apparently, is that we're in this intermediate temperature below the tricritical point where at low polarizations, you're in the SARMA phase, but as you go above this PC, it suddenly becomes phase separated. So again, all three of these temperature regimes that we've looked at are quite consistent with what you'd expect from this phase diagram. Now let's look at the MIT data. Subsequent to our paper, they began looking at in situ images as well, and they show a paired central region. They have a partially polarized shell. They see no distortions. They see only a paired center up to finite P. So we compare that to our high temperature data. They look very much the same. What you'd want to compare is the difference distribution down here to their difference distribution. They look very much the same, and although they have much better signal to noise than we do, because they have a lot more atoms, these distributions are indeed very similar. So MIT has reported that their data is evidence of phase separation, and I think that you heard Wolfgang say that this morning, that they're claiming that their gas is phase separated. But actually, if you look at their data, their difference distribution, there's no evidence whatsoever of any deformation. There's no peak and no dip, and which is what you would get if there were some kind of surface tension effects. This is their integrated density, completely flat topped. And that's in despite the prediction. This is a prediction by Hank Stoff, and you saw how good his theory fit our data. In fact, this aspect ratio that they predict for us is right on. This aspect ratio for the MIT trap should be diminished by about 15%. The 15%, the signal to noise is great. The 15% should be clearly visible here, and they're clearly not seeing it. You heard Wolfgang also today say that they went to an aspect ratio of about 50 with about 5 million atoms, so they'd be somewhere, I guess, down in here, down in here. And again, they saw no deformation. And so this is a concern. The deformation is the smoking gun for phase separation. Without deformation of the core, without surface tension, you can't have phase separation in some kind of an elongated geometry. So as far as I can tell, their claim of phase separation is based on having a normalized, is having a central densities. This is a central density difference as a function of polarization, which is zero in some region of polarization. But as we've seen, that's not sufficient. So we've seen both experimentally in our high temperature data and also in theory that having an equally paired center is not evidence of phase separation. The sum of phases also gives rise to an equally paired center. This is a property which is shared by the sum of phase. So let me summarize. So we've studied these polarized Fermi gas system, and we've seen phase separation. We've seen the smoking gun of phase separation, which is the deformation produced by surface tension. We may have seen the Sarma phase. We certainly, our high temperature phase agrees with the phase diagram that's theoretically predicted. We have not seen either the FFLO phase or the DFS phase. The phase separation shows no Clarkson limit at the unitarity limit, whereas the Sarma phase does. All right, so there are some open questions, and the open questions are why there is no Clarkson phase in the phase-separated phase, and I think that probably can be answered theoretically. And I think there's a big question of whether the MIT data is phase-separated as they claim or it's a Sarma phase. If it's phase-separated, why is there no surface tension? Are there problems with their temperature determination? Maybe they claim that their temperatures are the same as ours. Is that correct, or could there be a problem? I think that that's still an open question. They fit their temperature somewhat differently than we do. But also, as Wolfgang mentioned this morning, perhaps there's some kind of geometry dependence that gives rise to a different temperature scale for the phase separation. All right, so what we're doing now is mapping out this phase diagram. So this is coming from Mira Parrish's paper that was recently published, and I don't know if it's visible back there. It's a little bit difficult to see, but this is the axes that I've been showing before, which is polarization versus temperature, but there's also a third axis, of course, that you can probe, and that's interaction. This is magnetic field. So in this T equals zero plane, we're evidently pretty good at getting low temperatures, and so we're in the process now of probing this T equals zero plane, mapping out this phase boundary between the normal phase and the phase-separated phase on the BCS side, and also mapping out where the boundary is between the polarized superfluid and the phase-separated phase on the BEC side. Now, on the BCS side, there are predictions of, and I know Leo's been involved in this, but predictions of FFLO physics over in here, and so we're have our eyes open and are on the lookout for any kind of modulation that might indicate some kind of FFLO phase. So let me acknowledge the people involved in the work, in particular Guthrie Partridge, just finished his degree, Wenwei Li and Yan'an Liao, and whoops, I don't have a picture of Hank Stoff, but Hank Stoff is often involved in coming to Rice and hanging around, and I meant to put his picture in there as well. So. Let me also acknowledge Hank. All right, thank you very much.
Okay, we'll move the break up 10 minutes so we can have a full discussion on this paper. And let's start, Dan.
Do you want to do it in the mic?
No, but just a clarification, this Sarma phase shouldn't have an excess. Why should the core be perfectly paired in the Sarma phase? Isn't it supposed to be magnetized a slight bit so that there's actually an excess of one population? I didn't follow that.
Kathy, could you? You better,
in fact, the Sarma phase really is close to 50-50 until you get to very high temperature. It doesn't want to polarize the center, but he's plotting exactly at the center of the trap. It lets the polarization in, but not right at the center. So there is some polarization. You want to...
Yeah, Randy, the question is about low temperature data. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, all your temperatures have been determined only for unpolarized gases. Mm-hmm. And whereas in contrast, we have done interacting temperature, we have done ballistic temperatures, so I can't really see any problem in our temperature determination. Do you assume, I mean, if I give you the same credit for your temperature determination as you should give us, usually our error bars are much smaller than yours, is there a possibility that the tricritical point depends strongly on geometry, that there is some mesoscopic phenomenon in small samples which takes the temperature scale to another level?
Absolutely.
Right now, I mean, I would pretty much take for granted that your data and our data are taken in the same range of temperatures.
Let me address that. You mentioned the temperature fitting. So this is how we do the temperature determination. So this is very standard kind of method for fitting to a Thomas Fermi distribution. We fit the column densities, and we extract the temperature from that. So this is some examples. The low temperature data, you can see over in here, this happens to fit the 0.01. And you can see what the quality of the fit is. This is the black line is the low temperature. These are all in situ, by the way. And as I understand it, most of your thermometry is not. But let me just describe also the polarized cases. Okay. So the green line here is the finite temperature fit. So this is a fit for the higher temperature data of about 0.15. Now, fitting to the wings of the distribution is problematic from our perspective, and I know that your group does this. We've not done it. We do it, but we don't trust it because it seems to have some systematic bias. So this is an example of polarization of 0.35 where the core, the inner superfluid core, has a radius of RC. And so right here at RC, the core actually goes to zero. But nonetheless, you see an effect from the core even in the wings of the distribution where it's completely non-interacting. There's no overlap between these atoms and the core, but nonetheless, there's still a visible effect. So if you change where you make the cut when you do the fits, you get temperatures that range from, 0.1 here to 0.06, 0.06 to 0.13. And so there's a lot of fluctuations, and we simply don't trust it. If we go to the higher polarization data, where maybe you'd expect it to work even better because there's very few minority atoms, this is 95%, this is the radius of the core. And again, I think this really illustrates the effect the core has, even though there's no overlap between these two spin states, there is still an effect via the Fermi pressure. The core, the majority, is really peaking up here. It's very clear. Has a big effect on the temperature determination. This fits to 0.2. So I change that cut. This now fits to 0.1, 0.10, 0.07, 0.05, 0.04, and then back up to 0.12. So there's just a lot of fluctuations. We can't get any consistent fits. I mean, these kinds of temperature ranges are consistent with the temperatures that we're saying for the P equals zero data, but we simply don't trust those kinds of fits for the non-P equals zero data.
Looking at this data, my feeling is we have done various fits to wings, interacting cloud and all that. Our understanding is one cannot really trust those fit below 0.1. Sometimes you can say, it's 0.05, but eventually you do different cooling cycles, you think you have produced the same cloud and you certain fluctuations. So I'm not concerned if for one sample you change the cutoff and the temperature changes from 0.07 to 0.09.
The point is that for the unpolarized gases, you don't see that kind of fluctuation. You consistently get temperatures that are below 0.05 in the fits.
Well, we personally never trust fits which produce such low temperatures because we think that the temperature determination is not stable.
Could I ask, thinking about zero temperature and your phase-separated data, presumably there are some excitations where you take a particle from the polarized Fermi gas and stick it into the superfluid region. And when you increase the temperature, presumably you produce some sort of thermal population of those excitations. Do you have any feeling for what the energy scale for that is, and whether a kind of non-degenerate thermal cloud could fill things in increase the temperature?
That's a very rough question for me. That's not something that we can measure. That's something actually that has to come out of theory. No, I couldn't really give you anything. I could give you would be very hand waving.
Nandini.
So on the discussion of the Clarkston limit, do you have sort of independent measurements of, say, the gap with this RF spectroscopy method or something? Just to see whether, you know, where it vanishes or doesn't vanish with polarization.
Yeah, so for the unpolarized gases, there are, you know, certainly good Monte Carlo results on the gap. And so that's... Not with polarization. Yeah. Well, that's...
Maybe there's too much dependence of the crab shape on something like, you know, density difference in the center. That's like a little bit more of a detail.
Yeah.
And maybe if you ask a more macro question like the gap or
I think we have time for one more question, and there's a mic in the back.
Just to go back to this issue of the tricritical point, there are actually two possibilities, and I think some of the theories have one possibility and some have the other, and one is that the region, the second order line, goes into the top of the phase separator region, and that's a genuine tricritical point. And the other possibility, which I think was in Kathy's paper, was that the second order line goes into the side of the phase separator region, and in that case the apex of the dome there is just a regular critical point. It's a transition between two normal states. So it's a kind of, you know, interesting question which happens.
Yeah, that's a good point. So if I can go back to it. I guess you're pointing out this region over in here.
Yeah, that's right.
No, that's very interesting. And that, hopefully, by mapping out the phase boundaries as a function of polarization and interaction strength, we'll be able to say something about where, for example, where the tricritical point hits the t equals zero plane would give us some guidance, I think, on the theory.
The normal critical point is at is where the phase separator region closes. No, not that point. So that point has actually no significance at all from the point of view of critical phenomenon. The point to the right of it is is just a regular critical point where the dome closes.
Okay.
So
you mean over here?
There.
None of these other theories have the non-condensed pair physics, the pseudo-gap physics in them.
So you need to put in normal state fluctuations to have that, and obviously the things on the right, which basically mean field, don't have that, so you can't have any normal state transition, which is what's happening on the in Kathy's case.
How many chromosomes does the Sharma state have?
I think we should talk about it after the break and let everybody have a break, and then we'll do a little bit of theory, and I'll be happy to answer questions too. So I think we have to stop the cut it off at this point. But we will reassemble. How about 4:15? That's a 20-minute break, and then people just be prepared to stay a little late before they get on the bus.